Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David Benson, the 12th Hour Apostolic Presbyterian Congregation on behalf of the 12th Hour Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is September 4, 2017, or it is evening 14, 2020. We're going to start our first service today with a song entitled, He Lives. I serve a risen Savior, He's in the world today. I know that He is living forever, men will say. I see His hand of mercy, I hear His voice of cheer. In just the time I need Him, He's always near. He lives, He lives, Joshua lives today. He walks with me and talks with me the long last way away. He lives, He lives, salvation to Him pray. Bless me, how I know He lives. He dwells within my heart. And all the world around me, I see His loving care. And though my heart grows weary, I never will despair. I know that He is leading through all the stormy blast. The day of His appearing will come at last. He lives, He lives, Joshua lives today. He walks with me and talks with me along the narrow way. He lives, He lives, salvation to Him pray. Bless me, all oh, I know He lives within my heart. Rejoice, rejoice, O Christian, lift up your voice and sing. Eternal hallelujah to Yahshua the King. The hope of all who seek Him, the help of all who find. None other is so loving, so good and kind. He lives, He lives, Yahshua lives today. He walks with me and talks with me along the hill of faith. He lives, He lives, salvation to Him pray. Bless me, how I know He lives, He lives within my heart.
Revival Reformation Part 2. We're going to continue on our study here at the Time of Greeting, Volume 1, Number 10. We're on page 26. We'd just like a little bit to finish this up. Then we're going to go and do another one. And let's go now, let's do a little review from our last study. Let's review this here in Zechariah. It's all practically here in Zechariah. Well, let's continue on here. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 3, 8, and 9. And in that day, while I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people, all that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. In that day shall the Yahweh defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as the David, and the house of the David shall be as the Yahweh, as the angel of Yahweh before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. That is, after disintegrating the ancient kingdoms, Israel and Judah, he is again to reestablish and unify them as depicted in Ezekiel 36 and in other portions of the scriptures. At that time, Jerusalem, the city of the saints, is to become a burdensome stone for all the people of the earth. That is, they will hate the city and its inhabitants and will attempt to take it, but instead they will be cut in pieces. For the Yahweh will defend his people. Now, I want to make a comment here. This is a type of, at the end of the millennium, when the 100 years is up and all the wicked with Satan, once again, they go up and surround the holy city. And they still think that they can overthrow the city. Well, I just read to you where it says Jerusalem is a city of the saints, for the saints. Okay, once the Gentiles have been driven out, and the enemy has been driven out of Israel and Jerusalem, then it's going to be occupied with nothing but saints. It's going to be just the same way it's going to be when in heaven. And at the end of the millennium, again, you're going to have the wicked come up and try to take the city once and overthrow the city. Type and antitype. They said, then it is that even the most feeble among the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be as willing, as daring, and as capable as was ancient David, and the house of David, the kingdom, that is to be set up, which is but the church purified, no sinners among them, Isaiah 52:1, shall be as the angel of the Yahweh before the people. Since Zechariah's prophecy met only partial fulfillment in the days that the Jews returned from the Babylon unto Jerusalem, and since his writings speak interchangeably of another such movement, and which is to be greater than the former, there is therefore no doubt but that the latter is the antitype of the former. Hence the revival and reformation of the Zechariah's time is to repeat in our time, for the builder's future a failure to continue with the work and to bring revival and reformation before Haggai and Zechariah were called to the prophetic office, and their success after Yahweh through the prophets took over, perfectly demonstrate that without the living spirit of the prophecy in the midst, no revival reformation efforts can succeed. So you have to have a living spirit of prophecy in your midst. And that is why they all heretofore have failed. For the type also perfectly demonstrates that since Yahweh has now risen from his holy habitation, now this is Yahshua, since the Yahshua has risen from his holy habitation and has taken the reins in his own hands, and he did that in 2002, this is where it started, at the Passover, revival reformation is sure to triumph. It is therefore useless to agitate revivals and reformation while one knows not what and how actually to revive or to reform. It is commendable to hold up the standard, but it certainly is not in Yahweh's order for one to work up something and to call it revival and reformation. In the conclusion, let us summarize the two main points that our study of the afternoon has definitely made clear unto us. Number one, that a work and movement similar unto those in the Zechariah's day is successfully to bring revival and reformation among the Yahweh's people of today. That those who expect the promise blessing must wholeheartedly enter into it, that without the living spirit of the prophecy in our midst, there can be no success in any revival and reformation, and that the sooner we know it, the quicker we shall achieve our goal. First timely greeting number 10. Mount Carmel Center, 282 Davidian Way, Tamasea, South Carolina. This is where, this is the address to Donnie Adair that republished the Shepherd God. And so that ends our study of number 10, time to read volume 1, number 10. And so we're going to now go to number 8 and see what we have there. We'll back up to number 8 and start with page 1 on that. What makes one eligible? Letter of sin or Davidian? Which? Now that's a good question. It says, not a blessing, page 155. The very first step in approaching Yahweh is to know and believe the love that He has unto us. For it is through a drawing of His love that we are led to come unto Him. For the perception of Yahweh's love works the renunciation of the selfishness. In calling Yahweh our Father, we recognize all His children as our brethren. We are all a part of the great web of humanity, all members of the one family. In our petition, we are to include our neighbors as well as ourselves. No one prays aright who seeks a blessing for himself alone. Which art in heaven, he unto whom Yahshua bids us look as our Father is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. In his chair we may safely rest, saying, what time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. What does the reading instruct us to pray for? For an application of the Elohim's love and for better understanding of him. For the right understanding of what it means to pray the Yeshua's prayer. For wisdom to know why we address Yahweh as our Father. Why we are members of the one family, brethren of the one household. For grace to remember to pray not for ourselves only, but for our neighbors and even for our enemies. Okay, that's and the prayer thought. Let's go right on into the subject matter. What makes one eligible? A number of brethren have written unto me from time to time wanting to know what makes them eligible for the receiving of the seal of Yahweh. Some want to know whether they will be sealed by doing this or by doing that. Others want to know whether they will be left without the seal by not doing this or not doing the other. The questions are indeed very timely and commendable. Such vital questions deserve answers as concrete as are the questions themselves. And who can give a more concrete answer than those who have gone before us, those whose duties were similar unto ours, those who were passing through a similar experience, those who traveled the same road that we are traveling, those who are preparing themselves for the kingdom as we are. So what did V.T. Hellas say there in Volume 10? The kingdom of the house of David is the kingdom of heaven here on earth. The purified, he called it the purified church, house of David, is a purified kingdom here on earth. In whom do we find such a parallel? In no others than those who left Egypt and started for the promised land. No, and none others. They are our only type, says inspiration. Now all these things happen unto them for an example, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come, 1 Corinthians 10:11. Their duties, therefore, are our duties, and their failures should be our stepping stone to success. Thus it is that the deeds of those who entered into the promised land must be our deeds, and if we are to be sealed, and then the deeds of those who fail to enter therein, we must shun as completely and as quickly as we would shun a lion's den. We are now to find out why some of them went into the promised land and why others did not go in. This is what inspiration commands us to do. This scripture implies that if the experiences of the ancient Israel had not been for an example, they would never have been written. How important then that we diligently study them. Yes, in order for us to know what we must do or must not do to receive the seal and to enter into the promised land, we must examine the deed of both those who entered it and of those who were left out of it. Let us begin our examination by starting with Moses, with the human agent, the visible leader of the movement. And notice it says movement here. But the first movement, reared in the courts of the Pharaoh, he received the highest education the world then offered, and having understood that he was the one to free his brethren from the Egyptian bondage, he felt quite capable for the job. You remember the story of how he started out to deliver them, although he was not yet told to do so. He killed an Egyptian, fell into a quarrel with one of the Hebrews, and then fled for his life. So it was that in Midian he obtained a job, became a shepherd, and married his employer's daughter. During those 40 years of the shepherd's life, he forgot the Egyptian language, and with it, the Egyptian learning. In his place, though, he learned to tend well to sheep. He therefore dismissed from his mind the idea of ever delivering the people of Yahweh from their Egyptian bondage. Then it was that Yahweh saw him strong and well able and commanded him to go back to Egypt and to bring out of it his groaning people. You recall that Moses protested against the idea and argued that he had failed at his first attempt. The time he was young and well informed, and that at that late hour of his life he was not trying again, that he could no longer even speak the language. After a prolonged conversation, Yahweh removed his objections by promising to give him his brother Aaron to be his spokesman. And Moses finally consented to return unto Egypt. There, with his shepherd's rod, he performed many signs and wonders before both the Egyptians and the Hebrews. So the same thing today, with the shepherd's rod, this antipical Moses, Elijah David, he will also deliver Yahweh's people out of spiritual Egypt today. And you remember what took place the night of the Passover, the night before they left Egypt. Moses had proclaimed throughout the land that in every dwelling where no blood was found on the doorpost, that very night the firstborn in each such dwelling would die. Those who disobeyed the divine injunction were on the day fallen busily mourning and burying their dead, while those who obeyed the command were joyously and orderly marching out of the city. Yes, only those who were able to take orders were made free from the slavery. It is therefore a prerequisite that we learn to take orders if we are to receive the seal of Yahweh in our forehead. Let us not forget, though, that the children of Israel left Egypt with a great zeal and high hopes. But when they saw the Red Sea ahead of them and Pharaoh's army behind them, they were filled with consternation. They saw themselves in a death trap, although they were at the brink of another marvelous deliverance. Then they turned on Moses and accused him of bringing them to the sea, of making their escape from their enemies absolutely impossible. For the humanity, humanly viewing the situation, they were in a precarious predicament. In that moment, they forgot their miraculous deliverance from Pharaoh's taskmasters, and their eyes closed to the wondrous cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night that had led them all the way. As they sought the evidence against Moses' ability to lead them safely was overwhelming. Insofar as they were concerned, the whole venture appeared doomed to failure. Their hopes of going ahead or even going back left them, and all because they thought Moses, not Yahweh, was their deliverer. How short-sighted, unstable, doubting, and forgetful human beings are. Experience in the gospel work was taught me that Elohim's people of the day have the same tempter to contend with, and similar temptations to overcome if they are to receive the seal of Yahweh. What a great difference would there have been had the Israelites only believed that Yahweh, not Moses, was their leader, and that which appeared to be their death trap was their door of hope. Let their experience teach us to remember that Yahweh is either leading us altogether or not at all, that His ways are not our ways, and that what may appear to be our greatest obstacle may actually turn out to be our greatest blessing. Israel's real danger, we now see, was not in what Moses did, but in their unbelief of Yahweh's having the reins in His hand, and not knowing that His ways are beyond finding out, contrary to ours. They failed to see that Yahweh could again and again perform miracle after miracle to deliver them from their enemy's hand, that He could dry the ocean as easy as He could flood the earth. Having their failures before us, we should make them our stepping stones to success. Let us therefore wholeheartedly believe that Yahweh is in charge of our salvation, of our lives, and of our death too, that He is able to take us to safety, even if the earth should drop out of space, that we cannot die if He wants us alive, and that we cannot live if He wants us dead. Let us ever bear in mind that we of ourselves know nothing about Yahweh's plans except as told through His appointed servant, the prophets, and as we witness them day to day, if we daily walk with Yahweh, if we commit all unto Him, then the responsibility is all His. For the Yahweh in His wisdom brought Israel unto the Red Sea for their own good. And though they could not see it His way, He nevertheless, for His name's sake, divided the sea, took them safely across, and at the same time, by the same miracle, He destroyed their enemy. Had Moses been as doubtful of Yahweh's power and leadership as were the people that were with him, what effect but his rod of head as he struck the sea with it. None whatsoever. If the judgment of the infinite were the same as the judgment of the finite, then Pharaoh's army would have either killed or enslaved Israel anew. For their mighty deliverances should therefore forever establish our confidence in Yahweh, and should stand as the everlasting memorials that the wisdom of man is foolishness with Yahweh, and that faith in him does actually remove mountains and seas too. Notwithstanding these examples, though, men still expect Yahweh to work in accordance with their judgment, and that is why sometimes he uses children in his work instead of the wise and prudent men. For the Hebrew host well knew that they were led to the sea by the following of the cloud by the day and the pillar of the fire by the night. Yet none of these wonders seem to have made any lasting impression on them. There is a danger that we, too, may forget the way the Yahweh has led us. After Israel crossed the sea and after the sea closed in on their enemy, they all sang, gave Yahweh the glory, but though Pharaoh's army and the sea were no longer objects of the fear, but of the interest, their trials, doubts, and fears were not yet at an end. Almost immediately after they saw the sea behind and the desert ahead, they began to recriminate Moses for having brought them into the desert to starve there for want of the water and food. It never entered their minds that if Yahweh can dry the sea, he can certainly flood the desert and make it blossom as a rose. Notwithstanding their doubts and their moanings, Yahweh again performed an even greater miracle. He caused water to gush out of the rock, and he brought manna from the heaven. Today, as in the Moses day, many are duplicating the sins of that people. Some are all on fire one day and all on ice the next. Others praise Yahweh to the top of their voices while their ship is smoothly sailing. But when the sea becomes rough and the waves start beating against them, then they see only a man at the wheel, and rather than expecting Yahweh to calm the sea, they begin to hunt for a jumping off place. Still others are constantly trying to promote themselves by the continual fault finding against the ones that bear the whole burden of the load. So it is that there must be among us today antithetical doubters, complainers, office seekers, and fault finders, admitting one great truth one day and forgetting it the next day, yet expecting to be sealed with the seal of Yahweh and to stand with the Lamb on the Mount Zion. For the Yahweh fed his ancient people with the ancient food, the kind of their work and climate required. He delivered it fresh daily, and it did not cost them 1 cent. All they had to do was to bring it into their tents and to eat it. But they disliked the manna and wished they were back in Egypt, eating from his flesh pots, the leeks and the onions and the garlic. In their eyes, Moses was the greatest of sinners, and they blamed him for every trial of their faith. Had Yahweh given them something other than manna, they would have been just as dissatisfied with it because an evil spirit was in them. Let us gladly and with thanks eat and drink what the Yahweh gives us and when he gives it to us. For you recall that by the craving of the flesh food, they made the situation unbearable for the Moses. So, unto their great surprise, quail filled the camp, and the multitude carried them into their tent. But at what a cost, thousands of them died, even while the flesh was yet between their teeth. Then they understood that the manna was the best food. It was a great lesson, but an expensive one. What about us vegetarians? Their murmuring, however, did not end even then. They found something else to murmur about. They grew jealous of the Moses and Aaron. They are taking too much on themselves. The office seekers complain. We are just as much favored of Yahweh as are Moses and Aaron. Yahweh speaks with us as much as he speaks with them, they said. And who were the chief complainers? The princes of the nation, the men who were the most capable, the very ones who should have known better, those who could have been the greatest help unto Moses became the biggest hindrance unto him. They wanted Aaron's office. They wanted Moses' office. They refused to be satisfied with anything less. Yahweh himself got nowhere with them, for the only thing he could do was to cause the earth to swallow them. Thus, in one day, thousands, practically all the so-called wise fell into the bowels of the earth. Are we, too, seeking office by which to exalt self? Are we, too, endeavoring to usurp the seat of the Spirit of the Truth? Finally, the emancipated children of the Israel came into the borders of the Promised Land. And though they had witnessed great miracles right along, yet they did not believe that Yahweh could procure the land for them. They had seen that he was able to deliver them from Pharaoh's brickyards, to take them dry shod through the sea, to destroy their enemies, to give them food and water in the desert, where there was none to be had. Yet they did not believe that he was able to take the land for them and that he could finish what he had started. There are thousands a day who are doing verses the same when they say, Isaiah chapter 2, Micah chapter 4, Jeremiah chapter 31, and Ezekiel chapter 36 and 37 will never be fulfilled. It was those who were of the age, those who should have known better, that started the ball rolling down the hill to destruction. For the youth, of course, must have echoed the murmurings of their elders, but the Yahweh did not hold it against them. And in order to salvage the youth, Yahweh had to bury all their murmuring parents except the two faithful, trusting men who protested against the evil report of the other 10 spies. Mark ye, every adult that left Egypt except Caleb and Joshua had to be buried before the youth could cross the Jordan. Why? Because though Yahweh did take them with ease out of the Egypt, he could not get Egypt out of them. Are you still wondering why the prophet Elijah must turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers? Malachi 4:6. Christians often think that the Israelites were very wicked and unruly people. But after having their experiences to profit by, think how much worse he would be if we do as they did, if we do no better than they. How can we expect to be eligible for the seal and for the kingdom since they were not eligible? In the very prime of life, Moses thought himself capable of the delivering of the children of Israel. The prophet said, you are not fit for the work. Come out, and I will make you fit. And out Moses went. He did not need Pharaoh's training in order to do Yahweh's work. It was a hindrance unto him. Why? Because it made him self-sufficient, independent of Yahweh. Such a person would be the right one to lead Yahweh's people away from him and into sin, but the wrong one to lead them to Yahweh and away from sin. How true the statement in the Testimony of Volume 5, page 80. In the last solemn work, few great men will be engaged. They are self-sufficient, independent of Yahweh, and he cannot use them. Yahweh has faithful servants who, in the shaking, testing time, will be disclosed of you. Yahweh can help only those who know that they are unequal to their task, those who know that they need his help. So then, those who think that they can do wonders are the very ones who can do nothing but harm. Plainly, those whom Elohim is to use in his final work in the time of the end are not to be anything like the Egyptian crown prince, not anything like the learned Moses. Those who can learn to keep and feed sheep well and to readily take orders are the ones who can be taught how to keep and feed Yahweh's people. Moses' wife was the only Ethiopian in the entire company. For this reason, some thought they were superior to her. They thought that Moses had committed the unpardonable sin by marrying out of his nation. His old race had anything to do with making people superior or inferior. Moses' own sister, Miriam, was caught up in that sin. There she was, trying to break up his family. Yet Moses prayed for her recovery when she was stricken with the leprosy. And Yahweh, who went into the promised land, all but the murmurers. Do you suppose that you can entertain the same spirit of the murmuring and complaining, and in spite of it receive the seal? How absurd the very thought, how unfair it would be for a just Yahweh to destroy the disobedient of that day, but to save the disobedient of this day. What made one group eligible to cross the Jordan? It was their trust in the Yahweh, knowing that he was their chief leader. They recognized Moses and Joshua as the ones through whom Yahweh was communicating with them. They did not look upon them as being any one other than who they actually were. They were satisfied with their lot. They took orders as the orders were given. So it was that they were the only ones who entered into the land. Having these examples before us, this picture to go by, I can confidently tell whether I am headed for the kingdom or whether I am headed for the bowels of the earth, Revelation 12:16. And I'm sure that you too can tell which way you are headed. For the Yahweh does not require more or less of us than he required of our types. There is therefore no mystery as to what we must do and what we must not do to receive the seal of Yahweh. We need not go into a land of bewilderment, need not entertain the idea that we must have a mysterious feeling, exciting emotion, need not wallow in the dust or jump to the ceiling. No, we need not make fools of ourselves. All we need to do is to be ourselves. Be calm, decent, respectable, heaven-like beings, endeavoring to do Yahweh's will on the earth as it is done in heaven. We need not make a display of ourselves, but we need to mind our Elohim-given business and to keep our noses out of other people's business. Only when we have done all we can to comply with the requirements of the message for today, not of yesterday, shall we be sealed and stand with the Lamb on the Mount Zion. Should we not be glad that while we are being invited to the kingdom, we are also being told how to get there? Seeing all these, we must never let our confidence in Yahweh wane. We ought to be stable, from affirming everything, lacking in nothing. Yahweh's 11th hour servants. Now, I'm going to change this. Those 11th hour servants are servants for the last parabolic hour, and that's the 12th hour. So those that was called at the 11th hour, as the ones that Vicky Hardup inadvertently and indirectly is talking about, and that fifth group of laborers mentioned there in Matthew 20, verse 5 and verse 6, because Vicky Hardup is part of the fourth group of laborers in Matthew 20, verse 5, that called it the ninth hour. The 11th hour service was called at the 11th, end of the 11th hour to work in the 12th hour, and that's who we are today, the house of David. We're the 11th hour servants. So he says, for Yahweh's 11th hour servants, says inspiration, are to be a great people and a strong. There hath not been ever the like, neither shall be any more after it, Joel 2:2. They know what they believe what they know. Most important of all, they know that they are led by the Yahweh, not by the man. So, since Brother Johnson was in charge of the 11th hour, and it's from its beginning in 1970, shows that the 11 people that worked in the 11th parabolic hour was not this people that Joel chapter 2 verse 2 is talking about when he says there has not been a people inspiration for the 11th hour servants says inspiration ought to be a great people. There ought to be a great people and a strong people. There hath not been ever the like, neither shall be any more. After it, Joel 2:2. Well, if Brother Johnson represented this people, which I was with him, then I know that that Brother Johnson was the man of the hour for this 11th hour. But since he's already in his grave, this is impossible to even say that these 11th hour servants are the ones that worked in the vineyard in the 11th hour at Kermit, Texas. Now, it's those that's called at the end of the 11th hour that come through the judgment, closing out the judgment of the dead and starting the judgment of the living there in Kermit, Texas, 2002. So it says, let's continue. They are not like the Pharisees, who were building monuments in memory of the dead prophets, Matthew 23:29-31, and at the same time were slaying the living one. With this light shining on our pathway, Hebrews chapter 3, 4, 10, and 11, become self-interpreting. The sacred page. This is the name of a poem. This is the title to a poem. That ends this here, Timely Readings, Volume 1, number 7. A glory gilds the sacred page, majestic like the sun. It gives a light to every age, it gives but borrows none. For the Spirit breathes upon the Word and brings the truth to sight. Precepts and promises afford a sanctifying light. The hand that gave it still supplies the gracious light and heat. His truths upon the nation rise, they rise but never set. Let everlasting thanks be thine for such a bright display. It makes the world of darkness shine with beams of the heavenly day. Okay, that ends Timely Reading Volume 1, number 7. I thought I was doing number 8. And actually, I was supposed to go into Timely Readings, I thought, Volume 2, number 8. And so let's look at that. Timely Readings Volume 2, number 8. Revival and Reformation precede the great and dreadful day of the Yahweh. This is what our subject is all about. Our subject for this afternoon is found partly in Daniel 2, Matthew 4, and Jeremiah 51, Micah 5, and Malachi 4, but mainly in Joel chapter 2 and 3. We shall first turn to Malachi, verse 4, 5 and 6. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Yahweh, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers unto the children, and the heart of the children unto their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Here we have the promise that Yahweh is to send someone before the great and dreadful day of Yahweh. And when he comes, whether he accomplishes anything else, he is to turn the hearts of the fathers unto the children, and the hearts of the children unto their fathers. Now it appears somewhat puzzling that the hearts either of the fathers or of the children need to be turned toward the other. But if we consider that the work of the Elijah is not of a domestic nature, but spiritual, then we shall see that the Elijah's message is to intensify in the heart of the parents, as well as in the hearts of the children, a burden for the salvation of the other. Parents are very anxious to labor with other people's children, but seldom with their own. Likewise, children are anxious to preach unto others, but not so anxious to preach unto their own parents. For Elijah's message of the Revival Reformation, however, will place the burden of saving souls primarily where it belongs. His message will be seen to be be of the real importance rather than a theory. And when his followers fully realize that the great and dreadful day of Yahweh is at the door, they will be seen pleading first for those who are the nearest their hearts. Let us now turn to Daniel's prophecy of chapter 2, verse 44. And in the days of these kings shall the Yahweh of the heavens set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left unto other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. It is understood by the Bible students that this great image of the Daniel 2 represents the kingdoms from the Daniel's time down into the end. Here you see the stone which is cut out without the hand smites the image in the feet, and the stone fills the whole earth. In the days of these kings, our time, declares inspiration, Yahweh will set up the kingdom that is represented by the stone, and it will smite the nations and thereby bring their end. What could that day be but great for the Yahweh's people and dreadful for the nation? Indeed, it is to be the great and dreadful day of the Yahweh. Daniel 2:45. Forasmuch as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great Yahweh hath made known unto the king what shall come to the pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. Daniel's account of the event is very brief, but Jeremiah describes the day in the detail. Jeremiah 51:21-23. And with thee will I break in pieces the horse and his rider, and with thee will I break in pieces the chariot and his rider. With thee also will I break in pieces man and woman, and with thee will I break in pieces old and young, and with thee will I break in pieces the young man and the maid, and I will also break in pieces with thee the shepherd and his flock, and with thee will I break in pieces the husbandman and his yoke of oxen, and with thee will I break in pieces captains and rulers. Here inspiration explains that Yahweh with his kingdom, the everlasting kingdom of David that we are put in charge of, is to break the nations that has people, that his people are to be his battle axe. Both Daniel and Jeremiah are definite that the kingdom is to bring the kingdoms of the world to an end. Here inspiration explains that Yahweh with his kingdom is to break the nations that his people are to be his battle axe. Both Daniel and Jeremiah are the definite that the kingdom is to bring the kingdoms of this world to an end. Micah 5:7. And the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people, as the dew from Yahweh, as the showers upon the grass that tarrieth not for man, nor waiteth for the sons of men. For the remnant of Jacob, those who are left after the tares are taken out, that would be the 144,000 left, when once set up as a kingdom, is to be as the showers of blessing unto those who seek salvation, and as a lion that tears in pieces those who continue in their sin, the day shall be great to the one people. You see that lion, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the king of the south, the lawgiver, represented by that lion, and dreadful to the other. Now we turn to the chapters of Joel's prophecy that meet their fulfillment in the latter days. It says, Joel 2, 1 and 3. Blow ye the trumpet in Zion and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Yahweh cometh, for it is nigh at hand, a day of the darkness and of gloominess, a day of clouds and of thick darkness, as the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and a strong, and there hath not been ever the like, neither shall be any more after it, even in the years of many a generation. A fire devoureth before them, and behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the Garden of Eden, before them and behind them a desolate wilderness, yea, and nothing shall escape them. Here you see that a message is to be proclaimed unto the church, to Zion, declaring that the great and dreadful day of Yahweh is at hand, that it is to be devastating behind his people and glorious ahead of them, that Yahweh is thirsty to comb the field, that he is to gather every grain of wheat and then burn the tares, Joel 2, 4 to 6. For the appearance of them is as the appearance of horses, and as horsemen so shall they run, like the noise of the chariots upon the tops of the mountain, so shall they leap, like the noise of the flame of fire that devoureth the stubble, as a strong people sit in a battle array before their face, the people shall become much pain, all faces shall gather blackness. We see that the power which attended ancient Israel while they were taking the promised land shall also attend the servants of Yahweh at this gathering time. Nothing shall be able to hold down the people of Yahweh. Everyone shall perfectly attend unto his bidding. They shall gather the fruits of the earth, and nothing shall hurt them. For the spirit of prophecy testified, as the saints left the cities and villages, they were pursued by the wicked who sought to slay them, but the swords that were raised to kill Yahweh's people broke and fell as powerless as a straw. Early writings, page 284-285. Joel 2:9. They shall run to and fro in the city, they shall run upon the wall, they shall climb up upon the houses, they shall enter in at the windows like a thief. The servants of Yahweh shall certainly gather all their brethren out of all nations. Isaiah 66:20. Indeed so, for the legs of the gospel are the legs of the people who proclaim it. Of course, only with the perfect coordination and a bulletproof army can the gospel work be finished when the two-horned beast declares that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Revelation 13:15. Joel 2:10-11. For the earth shall quake before them, the heavens shall tremble, and the sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. Yahshua shall utter his voice before his army, for his camp is very great, for he is strong and executes his word, for the day of the Yahshua is great and very terrible, and who can abide it? Having announced how great and dreadful the day is to be, the Yahshua is making this plea. Joel 2:12-14. Therefore also now, says the Yahshua, turn ye even unto me with all your heart, and with fasting, and with weeping, and with mourning. And rend your heart and not your garments, and turn unto the Yahweh your Elohim, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and repenteth him of the evil. Who knoweth if he will return and repent and leave a blessing behind him, even a meat offering and a drink offering unto the Yahweh your Elohim. Yahweh's plea is that we prepare to meet the day, that now as sincere Christians who realize that for such an hour as this has this message of the mercy come unto us, repentantly return unto him. Joel 2:15-16. Blow the trumpet in Zion, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, and those that suck the breast, let the bridegroom go forth of his chamber, and the bride out of her closet. In these verses, as in Joel 2:1, the command is given to blow the trumpet in Zion. This second trumpet, however, is not to announce the day of Yahweh, but to sanctify both a fast and the people, to call a solemn assembly, from which not one is to be excluded from the assembly. Joel 2:17. Let the priests, the ministers of Yahweh, weep between the porch and the altar. Let them say, spare thy people, O Yahweh, and give not thine heritage reproach, that the heathen should rule over them. Wherefore should they say among the people, where is your Elohim? Here we are plainly told that Yahweh's people are to face persecution and distress, and that unless they keep close to Yahweh, their very existence may be at stake, Yahweh's name dishonored, and the heathen allowed to rule over them and to challenge their faith in Yahweh. Joel 2:18-19. Then will Yahweh be jealous for his land and pity his people. Yea, the Yahweh will answer and say unto his people, behold, I will send you corn and wine and oil, and you shall be satisfied therewith, and I will no more make you a reproach among the heathen. Yahweh finds refuge and freedom for them in their own land, where nothing shall be lacking. Joel 2:21-23. Fear not, O land, be glad and rejoice, for the Yahweh will do great things. Be not afraid, ye beasts of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness do spring, for the tree beareth her fruit, the fig tree and the vine do yield their strength. Be glad then, you children of Zion, and rejoice in Yahweh your Elohim, for he hath given you the former rain moderately, and he will cause to come down for you the rain, the former rain, and the latter rain in the first month. It is plain enough to see that Yahweh is speaking unto his people who are to receive both the former and the latter rain in the first month. So this would then be the house of David. Elijah David now is to take this former and latter rain that I received, and my wife and I received in 2002 at Kermit, Texas, at the Passover, start the Passover, the year 2002, Brother Johnson delivered the former and the latter rain, but he didn't understand how to apply it. And I am to take it now and to apply it at the appointed time, and that's for the sanctifying of the congregation. This will be at the revival and reformation that will take place to bring forth the 144,000 on this former and latter rain. This will be taught to the 144,000. This is that new song they're going to sing. They're going to learn this new song. They're going to sing, as it were, a new song. But it's going to be the same old song, the song of Moses and the song of the Lamb. This brings the close of our study. This is our contest. This is at the 11th hour. Call us number 11. Click on our audio archive. We're going to close this service now with a song. Over the Sunset Mountains.
Over the Sunset Mountains. Someday I'll softly go into the arms of Yahshua. He has loved me so. Over the sunset mountain, heaven awaits for me. Over the sunset mountain, Yahshua my Savior I'll see. Calling the whole be over, shadows will flee away, sorrow will be forgotten. Oh, what a wonderful day. Over the sunset mountain, heaven awaits for me. Over the sunset mountain, Savior of peace.